All right, so today we're going to dive into a case that really highlights the whole clash between like pro sports and, you know, that amateur ideal of college athletics. We're talking Jeremy Bloom, Olympic skier, right endorsements coming in left and right, but he also wants to play college football for the University of Colorado.
Yeah, and it wasn't like he was just starting out with endorsements, you know. He was already a big-time sponsored athlete in a whole different sport. So it brings up this like fundamental question the NCAA has always wrestled with. What does it actually mean to be an amateur athlete? Where do you draw the line financially?
Right, like why should his skiing money affect him playing football? It's like two separate worlds almost. And that's what today's deep dive is all about. Bloom v. NCAA, a case from back in 2004. We've got the actual court decision, some breakdowns of the legal arguments, and even some analysis written about it at the time.
Exactly. We're going to unpack why the NCAA went after Bloom's endorsement money, even though it had nothing to do with football.
Mm-hmm.
What arguments his lawyers made and what the court ultimately decided. It gives us a real look into the whole foundation of NCAA amateurism rules. And, you know, this is super relevant even now with all the talk about name, image, and likeness rights, NIL.
Definitely. So, okay, the NCAA has always been about keeping this line between college and pro sports. But what was their reasoning for saying no to Bloom? Even the university was on his side.
Well, you got to look at the NCAA's perspective historically. You know, okay. It goes beyond just a line. They always argue that endorsements could create this uneven playing field between schools, you know, leading to bidding wars for athletes and taking the focus away from academics and the love of the game. They even worried about, like, sponsors having too much influence and messing with the integrity of college sports.
Wow. So the NCAA just shut him down, even though the university was supporting him. That must have been frustrating for Bloom. So he's this incredible skier with all these deals, wants to play football at CU. What exactly did the NCAA do to stop him?
Their stance was super clear. If Bloom wanted to play football, he had to ditch the skiing endorsements. It was all about their bylaws aimed at preventing college athletics from becoming too commercialized. And they interpreted that to mean no student athlete could profit from any endorsement while playing, even if it came from a totally unrelated sport. It was like a blanket ban trying to maintain this separation between amateur and professional.
And I remember reading that Colorado, the university itself, actually tried to help Bloom navigate this whole mess, right? They didn't just abandon him.
Oh, absolutely. They understood his situation was unique and actually petitioned the NCAA for waivers on his behalf. They were basically saying, look, his skiing endorsements have zero impact on his football skills or our athletic program. But the NCAA held firm, denied the waivers, and stuck to their hardline interpretation of the rules.
So at that point, Bloom must have felt like he had no other choice but to sue. What were the big legal arguments that his lawyers presented?
His legal team basically went after the NCAA's rules, saying they were arbitrary and capricious. Now, this is a tough legal standard to meet when challenging administrative decisions. It basically means proving the decision had no reasonable basis or was made without considering important factors. They claimed these rules were unfairly restricting Bloom's rights, especially since his income was from a completely separate sport. They wanted the court to declare the NCAA's rules invalid and issue an injunction to prevent them from making him ineligible.
Okay, so they went for a preliminary injunction first. What was Bloom hoping to achieve with that?
A preliminary injunction is like an emergency request to the court to temporarily stop something while the case is going on. Bloom wanted the court to block the NCAA from declaring him ineligible so he could play football while his lawsuit was being decided. But the trial court said no to this request, meaning Bloom couldn't play while the legal battle continued.
Which takes us to the appeal, right? The Colorado Court of Appeals took over the case. Now, the first thing they had to figure out wasn't even about the rules themselves, but whether Bloom even had the right to bring this case in the first place. Let's talk about this standing concept.
Right. Standing is super important. The court found that Bloom did have standing to sue, but not directly. They said he was what's called a third-party beneficiary of the contract between the NCAA and its member schools like Colorado. Think of it like this. The NCAA makes rules, and schools agree to follow them to be members. Student athletes don't sign that agreement, but they benefit from it because those rules determine their eligibility. So they have a right to make sure those rules are being followed correctly.
Okay, so he's a beneficiary. Like, if my parents hire a tutor for me, I benefit from the tutoring, but I can't suddenly demand the tutor also makes me dinner, right? Because that wasn't part of the original deal.
Yeah, that's a perfect analogy. As a third-party beneficiary, Bloom's rights were limited by the terms of that contract between the NCAA and the universities. He couldn't just demand extra stuff or loopholes that weren't already in the agreement. The court was clear. He couldn't get special treatment.
Right. So being a beneficiary gave him the right to sue, but also put limits on what he could actually challenge. So now we get to the core issue. The NCAA's amateurism rules themselves. Did the court think these rules banning endorsements were actually reasonable under the law?
And here's where they sided firmly with the NCAA. They emphasized that preserving amateurism is a totally legitimate and important goal for the NCAA to have. They want to keep that fundamental difference between college sports, which are supposed to be about education and the love of competition, and pro sports, which are all about money and business.
I get that. But even if they want to maintain a line, isn't it kind of arbitrary to punish an athlete for making money in a different sport? How does that connect to fairness in college football?
The court acknowledged that specific point, but they stressed that these rules were applied equally to all student athletes. It wasn't like they were picking on Bloom specifically. The NCAA's reasoning was this blanket ban on all endorsement money to keep that separation crystal clear. They worried that allowing exceptions even for unrelated endorsements could open a can of worms and make it harder to regulate the commercial side of college sports.
So it seems like the court was pretty hesitant to question the NCAA's judgment on what amateurism actually means. Like, they're basically saying, you're the experts, we trust your decisions.
Exactly. Unless Bloom could show that the NCAA's rules were completely irrational, discriminatory, or violated some fundamental legal principle, the court wasn't going to step in and substitute their judgment. They recognized the NCAA's role as the governing body for college sports and gave a lot of weight to their policy choices.
And there was that Rathke test you mentioned earlier about the preliminary injunction. Can you explain why Bloom didn't get that temporary order to let him play?
So the Rathke test is a six-factor analysis that Colorado courts use for preliminary injunction requests. Actually, the court agreed with Bloom on a few of them. They acknowledged that he'd probably suffer irreparable harm by losing his college football career money. Money wouldn't fully fix that, and letting him play temporarily would maintain the status quo.
So what was the problem? Why didn't he get the injunction?
The key factor where Bloom's request failed was the likelihood of him actually winning the whole case, because the court already decided the NCAA's amateurism rules were reasonable and consistently applied. They didn't think he'd ultimately be successful. Also, they considered the balance of fairness and public interest. They weren't convinced that letting Bloom make money while playing college football was good for the bigger picture of protecting the NCAA's vision of amateurism.
Got it. So even though he could sue, his arguments against the rules just weren't strong enough for the court, especially when it came to getting that immediate relief. Are there any quotes from the court's decision that really stand out and show their thinking?
Yeah, definitely. The court said it pretty clearly. The clear import of the bylaws is that student athletes do not have the right to simultaneously engage in endorsement, activity, and maintain eligibility. They also addressed the NCAA's main goal, saying they wanted to retain a clear line of demarcation between intercollegiate athletics and professional sports. These quotes show how much the court accepted the NCAA's goals and how clear-cut the rules were.
Sounds like a big win for the NCAA back then. What happened afterward? What was the impact of the Bloom v. NCAA decision?
It really solidified the NCAA's power to make and enforce its amateurism rules and showed how much deference courts were willing to give them. It also showed how hard it was for athletes to challenge those fundamental amateurism principles.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's almost like a time capsule of a different era in college sports.
Right, and this all happened before the huge changes with name, image, and likeness rules. How does Bloom fit into the world now where athletes can actually profit from their personal brand?
That's the interesting part. Bloom shows us what it was like before NIL, when the NCAA had way more control over athletes and their commercial activities. It highlights that tension between athletes wanting to benefit from their fame and the NCAA's commitment to amateurism. Even though athletes have much more freedom with NIL now, Bloom still reminds us of how powerful the NCAA is and how complicated it can be to challenge their system. The arguments about separating college and pro sports might be different now, but they're still relevant as we debate the future of college athletics.
So for our listeners, especially those law students out there, what's the big takeaway from our deep dive into Bloom v. NCAA?
For law students, this case is like a textbook example of administrative deference and the limits of being a third-party beneficiary. It shows how courts usually deal with challenges to rules made by organizations like the NCAA. As long as those rules are reasonable and applied fairly, courts probably won't intervene. It also clearly illustrates how the rights of a third-party beneficiary are strictly controlled by the original contract.
Lots to think about, especially as the legal side of college sports keeps changing. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Bloom v. NCAA, here's something to consider. Given that athletes have NIL rights today, how do you think the arguments and the outcome in Bloom v. NCAA would be different if the case happened now? Would the court decide the same way? It really makes you think about how the relationship between amateurism and making money in college sports has shifted and how that would affect legal interpretations and court decisions. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
My pleasure.